remarkably different from what they've been in the past. So I have no idea that there will be a freshness to it as well, in part because I'm looking forward to everyone who's sitting in to share your experience as well as anything I have to say. Okay, so so for me, for some time now, a kind of a recurring theme or a question, a line of inquiry, as we find ourselves facing this sort of variety of really kind of powerful challenges. You know, whether it be the climate crisis or the public health emergency that we're all living through now, radical social inequity and the way that that's manifesting in the streets and in our politics at this stage of the game, environmental injustice, it seems like everywhere we turn, you know, natural disasters, there is a, that it's almost like there's one set of challenges after another that are being presented, but they're all being presented at the same time. So, as I look at these multiple challenges, from the standpoint of Buddha Dharma, I am less struck by what the apparent divergences in subject matter than I am by the similarities in terms of root cause. And the root cause, according to the teachings of the Buddha, in one way or another, all has to do with the kalesas, or the torments of the mind, the three poisons, attachment, aversion, delusion, or greed, hate, and delusion. How they manifest individually in our own lives, and how they can all also manifest at kind of a societal level. And so for me, a continuing line of inquiry and of study, of reflection, of discussion with some of you in the Sangha has been, and it's a question that's been around from the time of the Buddha, how can we use the Eightfold Path to liberate not only ourselves, but our society from the forces of greed and hate and delusion? So the answer is the same now as it has been then. The path that leads to personal liberation can also lead to social and cultural liberation as well. And that social liberation doesn't depend on everyone being Buddhist, but it does depend on enough people in any given society wanting to free themselves from these forces, however we perceive them to be manifesting, to join together and take action to do so. And as I've been thinking about these things and how to bring Buddha Dharma to bear on circumstances we find ourselves in now, I've been spending a little bit of time looking at the the modern history of the liberation theology movement in Central and South America, where we had some of, you know, some pretty senior clerics, as well as a lot of the priests down in the trenches, looking at the radical social inequities and the violence accompanying them that was happening in Central and South America, and saying, well, you know, for the better part of the last 400 years, it looks like more often than not, the Catholic Church has actually been complicit in the oppression of the least fortunate in these countries. And is there a way that teachings of Jesus can be brought to bear in a more direct way on the cessation of their suffering rather than its perpetuation? And so one of my favorite liberation theologians from that era was Dom Aldeira Camara, the Brazilian archbishop. And my favorite quote of his is, he said, "When I ask for food for the poor, they call me a saint. And when I ask why the poor have no food, they call me a communist." So, it's a fine line. And it's, you know, it's something that that certainly that Kathy brought up in her talk last week. You know, it's how can we bring the teachings of the Buddha to bear on social circumstances while recognizing that there's not just one answer to that question, that it can manifest in a whole lot of different ways. And it's kind of left to each of us to figure out how we're going to do that and then gather together with others who, you know, who want to walk the same path. So what I want to do this evening as a way to better explore how to bring the Buddha's teachings to bear on social liberation is to begin by reviewing the Buddha's teachings on how to bring about one's personal liberation. And in order to do that, I want for us to review together briefly his teachings on the Eightfold Path, the path to liberation, how it works. And then after having done that, kind of circle around again and say, okay, how can that same model be brought to bear on social liberation as well? So whether you've heard this a bunch of times before or whether it's relatively new to you, I want to walk us through that path again. So we all have that, you know, sort of common understanding, base understanding. So the Buddha's teachings, yes, the four ennobling truths, suffering exists. The origins, causes of suffering have to do with clinging, with wanting things to be different than they are. The means of liberation from that suffering is the abandonment of clinging. And then the fourth ennobling truth is how to go about doing this. And the visual depiction of the Buddha's teaching on this is a Dharma chakra or Dharma wheel, an eight-spoked wheel. And so the way he taught it, you know, first you have to gain entry into the path. You have to find the trailhead before you can get started. How do you find the trailhead? Well, the Buddha said the way that it's discovered, kind of like a little secret place in the forest that you didn't know was there until it becomes apparent. He said, what happens in one's life, just like happened for him, is that there is the experience of dissatisfaction, of not liking things the way they are, maybe including not liking yourself the way you are, just kind of wanting things to be different. So there's this sense of distress or ennui or angst or just not feeling kind of at home and at peace and at ease with things as they are. And wondering why that's so. Then he said, at some point you do something that's really beneficial for another. You know, an act of generosity, maybe. And that as a result of doing that, there is this feeling that arises in the mind, one of well-being, of contentment, of ease. And it's the experience of not suffering. It's the experience of the absence of dukkha. It's the experience of the absence of dissatisfaction. It's being just at peace with, in balance with, in harmony with things as they are. And then there's that recognition, aha, there was this beneficial act that I did, and it had this effect. I wonder how I can learn to live a life that involves having that experience again. And so once that motivation is begun, the turning of the wheel, the Buddha said, then that's when you enter into the path. And as he taught it, the first steps along this path are training of the mind, the meditative qualities of cultivating, wise effort of figuring out how to proceed in a patient and focused way, not craving or clinging to a particular goal, but having some confidence that just going along this path is going to maybe get you where you want to go, right effort. Then the establishment of a calm, contemplative, focused mind, gathering the mind's faculties in order to be able to examine itself, samadhi, concentration. And with those two together, then what begins to flower, become more and more powerful, is mindfulness itself. This one's ability to actually look into what's going on in the mind. You know, so the mind becomes calm and clear. There's a wholesome motivation. And then the power, the ability of the mind to look at itself, to examine what's going on and to understand what it's seeing, just becomes that much greater. Once those conditions have been met, like kind of the preparation of the soil, then what happens, and these are the three meditative factors, three spokes of the wheel, what then becomes possible is the ascertainment or the experiencing of what the Buddha called the wisdom factors. And the first of those is the ability to develop penetrative insight into wise understanding or wise or right view of what literally is going on in the mind. Not only what's going on in our mind, but what's going on in everyone else's mind and what's going on in the world in general, which is to say, the more carefully you look at what's at the nature of mind, especially the thoughts and emotions that arise, then you begin to attain some understanding of why, in fact, you're having the thoughts and emotions that you are. Where are they coming from? What is instigating them? What's bringing them forth? And you begin to understand that it's not just random. It's not just like you're channel surfing or something, that there are, in fact, energies or forces or patterns that are bringing forth the things that come to your mind when you're meditating, that begin to arrange themselves in patterns. When certain patterns of thought and emotion, whether they're memories of the past or thoughts about the future, certain kinds of powerful emotions begin to arise, you begin to understand them as being part of your personal history, of the way you were treated in your lifetime, the things that were done to you, both beneficial and unwholesome, the things that you said and did as a result. And so you begin to get more and more a deeper and deeper understanding into who you are just by the mind's ability to reflect upon its own content. And you begin to see this cause-effect relationship between how you behave and what the outcome was. As the mind gets better at doing that, then you begin to also be able to not only look into your own past, but look into your future. Because when you look into your past, you can see when the mind was imbued with greed, hate, and delusion, and I said it did something based on those forces of mind, this was the outcome. It was unwholesome. It was unhelpful. It was painful to myself and others. With that self-knowledge, then when you're looking toward the future, toward your intentions in the moment as to what you might want to say or do in the moment and why, then you can begin to see more clearly when you are acting on unwholesome intentions, it's going to probably result in a bad outcome. And when you refrain from doing that, and when you really focus on acting only on wholesome intention, it's going to result in a better outcome, right? And it's going to manifest in speech and in deed and in a way of life in a way that helps bring an end to suffering for yourself and those around you, okay, rather than its perpetuation. So that's the model. The eight spokes are connected in the center to an empty hub, the place of emptiness, of wisdom and compassion that informs and connects them all. They're connected to an outer rim, which is where the Dharma hits the dirt, how one applies each of these mind qualities to life in the world. No one's, in order for the wheel to function correctly, each of the spokes needs to be a relatively the same strength. You can't have some that are real strong and others that are not, because things get lopsided. So that's the model for individual liberation. Okay. It's ongoing, cyclical, never ending. Okay. And you know, sometimes it spins better than others, okay, but we do what we can to work with it to see where it may take us. Getting back to particularly the wisdom factors, panya, the wise understanding, a wise view, and then wise intention. The deeper one can look into the view, the understanding of oneself and of dependent origination overall, how everything is always co-creating everything else. When we first start to look at the places where we may have really screwed up in the past, what usually or oftentimes arises is the feelings of guilt or shame, or self-aversion for the way we may have behaved. And the feelings of guilt and shame arise out of a sense of self, out of, oh, look at these terrible things I did, and therefore I must be a really bad person. Okay. The deeper the insights get, and the more one begins to understand the Buddha's teachings about not self, the more their relationship to those memories begins to change, so that instead of feeling about that I did or said a bad thing or caused a bad result, therefore I am a bad person, there begins to arise the wisdom to not take the whole thing so personally. In other words, along with insights that come with the wisdom factors comes insight into the nature of not self. So what happens when that begins to arise, when you come to see the sort of the emptiness of those words and deeds, then it becomes apparent that the guilt and shame come from looking at the history of those actions from the perspective of a self who's bad or who did bad things. Once you begin to take in and get a better understanding of the Buddha's teachings on not self, and you realize the self is not an a permanent and abiding entity, and that you are the same now as you were whenever you did whatever you did, but that rather the self is arising and passing in each moment, then instead of it being me who did those things, it was whoever I was in that moment in time. And when you're able to make that shift, the guilt and shame are transformed into remorse. So there can be a real deep sense of remorse or lamentation or grieving almost for what happened then, for the pain that you were in, the suffering state of mind that you were in that caused you to behave in that way. Or if it was something that was done to you, then you can begin to get insight into the tortured state of mind of the person it was who inflicted the suffering on you. And in either situation, it becomes a little less personal because it becomes evident that all this happened in a state of flux. And yes, this is part of your history. Yes, these things did happen. And yes, they happened in a fluid, ever-changing environment that was based upon who you were and who that other person was at that point in time, which is not how things are now. It doesn't mean not taking responsibility for, you know, whatever these past words and actions may have been. But it does mean that instead of having the weight of guilt for what happened then hanging around one's neck, it gives you the opportunity to use your insights into the nature of your past conditioning and the nature of your current intention to say, oh, that's how this karmic heritage, what I inherited in terms of all these past behaviors and their consequences, provide an opportunity for me to learn how not to replicate that in the future. That's why we call it insight meditation. You gain these insights into your own history and your own motivations and your own behavioral patterns so that once you wake up to them, when similar triggering circumstances present themselves, you have the freedom that you didn't have before to respond in a different way and to bring suffering to an end. Okay. So before I go any further, does anyone have any questions about that model as it applies to the individual person, how it applies to us in terms of individual liberation? Hands? No, another? Okay. Well, then. Now we apply the same model to our society. And what we're invited to do, just as we do with our own personal histories, is to say, okay, how do we apply that understanding or that view, not just to our individual karma and how we are seeking to free ourselves from it, how do we apply that understanding to our collective karma, to our karma as a culture, as a society, as a nation, as a species on the earth? What is it about present day dukkha or suffering that we're experiencing that as a society, as a nation, we collectively created through past behavior based upon the kalesis? And then once we start to wake up to that, how can we use that awakening process to cease replicating that kind of suffering? So, like I was saying earlier, we're up against some really interesting challenges right now. There's global heating and climate change, radical social inequities, and societal and environmental injustice, public health disasters, an economic system that's in partial collapse, manifested in part by, you know, hundreds of thousands of people all over our country on the streets because they don't have any place to live. Okay, and we see that on our own streets every day. Everywhere we turn, we've got a lot of manifestations of how these forces have caused us to be where we are. So what do we do about them? Among those this evening, I'd like to take up and have us look together and maybe talk about a little bit. The one of radical social inequities and social injustice. I've been reading, as I know some of you all have as well, doing a fair amount of reading on the subject, including Isabel Wilkerson's recent book on caste and the origins of our discontents. And what she does is to suggest that we use the model or the concept of caste rather than race as a way to look at, you know, the current social strife that we're experiencing right now. Because in some ways it's a more powerful way to develop deeper insights into all that's going on. It's also quite intersectional in nature. It brings together ethnic lineage and socioeconomic status and history and culture in a pretty powerful way. So it starts with, and one of the things that in terms of my own background and research, where I've taken these arguments that she doesn't, is looking at the history of post-feudal Europe at the time that the world colonization by European nations began. So all of those nations, you know, England, Holland, France, Spain, Portugal, all the ones who would become the most powerful colonizers at the time, were very rigidly hierarchical, militarized monarchies with quite rigid social structures, with nearly all of the power and influence concentrated at the highest levels of the social structure, and the fairly brutal enforcement of the hierarchy by those in power. The wealth and the power of all those nations was dependent upon an abundant supply of very cheap labor, provided by the powerless, by the ones who were kept in their place, who were controlled through the imposition of conditions of scarcity, kept in fear, and kept servile. And that was the source of the power of the elites. The problem in the 16th and 17th centuries is that they were running out of resources within their own nation states. And so as the technology allowed, they began this mad scramble, radiating out all over the globe, trying to find a new natural resource base and also to find a cheap labor force to help them exploit it that they could control. So at least insofar as the Americas were concerned, the British and the Dutch and the French made for North America, the Spanish and the Portuguese made for South America. And then of course the Spanish tried to get into North America, the British tried to get down in the Caribbean. And there was a lot of tussling, a lot of warfare going on actually in the Atlantic. And finally, at least the take I got on it was that the Pope interceded and cut a deal between Northern and Southern Europe and said, okay, all right, let's give Central and South America to the Spanish and the Portuguese, and we'll give, you know, everything north of Florida to the British and the Dutch and the French. And so that's how they went forward. But they all did it with the same incredibly rapacious and enormously greed-driven motivation that resulted in all of them, except for the French, committing these incredible crimes against humanity. You know, the enslavement and the genocide of indigenous peoples in the Americas. And when they couldn't get the indigenes, you know, when they turned out to be inadequate slave labor, they started importing enslaved people from Africa to do the work for them. And so that's kind of where we got the system of enslavement that we have in this country. And it's what we inherited. The question is now, and it's the argument that she makes in her book, is say, that's the hand we got dealt 400 years ago, right? It was a powerful, morally corrupt elite that was willing to do these horrible things to people that they kidnapped and enslaved in order to make themselves fabulously wealthy and powerful. And then in her book, she carries that forward and says, all right, that's what happened then. This is the historical hand we got dealt. Are there ways in which we still manage our society in the present day that reflects the origins of that system when it was first established? In fact, do we continue to organize and administer our society in a way that is still intent on providing an abundant source of cheap labor that is necessitated by or made needful by keeping people in a constant state of deprivation, of being fearful of their means of survival, which is exactly what all the European powers, the elites, were doing to the subordinate castes in their own countries and doing it here. Do we still do that today? Do we still administer our society in such a way today that has the same effect, that constrains opportunity, that constrains the ability to take care of oneself in society? If that in fact is the case, and are we also using the power of the state to enforce that hierarchy? If that is indeed the case, what are steps that need to be taken in order to dismantle it? So that's the question she poses, and of course she has her own answers. But it seems to me that it is, to some extent, for each of us to ask the same questions. You know, are there ways in which we structure our society that are perpetuating the colonial karma that we inherited? And if there are, what are some things that we can do in order to begin to liberate ourselves and each other from the karmic heritage that we that is ours? I know I've told some of you before that when I was on the CU faculty, I taught for a while in the criminal justice program there, the graduate criminal justice program, where they were training police officers to be senior command level officers and managers and chiefs of police departments. And we had some remarkable, and these are the people that were really trying to do the right thing. They were really trying to reform policing, make it more humane, more service oriented, try to beef up social services to start providing some of the same functions that the police were being called upon because no one else was doing it. And among the more kind of revealing and frank discussions that we had was, you know, and they would say, well, you know, if we really get honest about it and serious about it, core function of policing in this country is to protect those with wealth and power from those who have none. Really quite Marxist in a way. That's the bottom line. To protect those who have wealth and influence from those who don't. And until we get clear about that and ask ourselves, is that really all we want policing to be about? You know, to be some kind of shock absorber or buffer between these strata of radical inequality in our society. You know, they don't want to necessarily be going out there doing these sweeps of homeless people on the orders of the mayor, the government of Denver. But the government of Denver has done next to nothing to try to otherwise address the plight of the people who have nowhere to live. And so in that way, it seems as if they are, in fact, simply trying to enforce a social order that is, you know, they've been ordered to reinforce a social order that bespeaks a radical inequality. And so what then do we do, as it says in the New Testament? Is there something that we who profess to embody and bear witness to the Dharma, are there ways that we can or should be bringing the Buddha's teachings on the Eightfold Path to personal liberation to bear on social liberation as well? That's the question. And it's not for me to provide the answer. It's for me to share the question with the Sangha and for us to explore together ways that that question might be answered. So the floor is open. Invite any questions or comments anyone may have. Honey? If you can unmute. There you go. Thank you.
Paul here. I want to pick up on the theme of what can we do with regards to these.
Is that you, Paul?
Yeah, that's me. Sorry. Here I am.
Oh, can you hear?
Can you hear
Can't
me?
Can't hear you.
Can't hear me. Hang on.
I just turned up the volume. Turn up the volume all the way.
Are we on mute or not?
No, we're unmuted.
Okay. Lloyd, can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay. So I'm just wondering, when we talk about structures of government, one of the challenges that I see is that many times we would look at institutions and say it's the institution that is the problem. But as we dig a little further, we find that the root causes of some of these inequalities, specifically how do we deal with homelessness, really comes back to the mind of the people in the perhaps the neighborhoods where there might be changes that could affect significantly the inequalities that exist. Point being, the attempt by the city to establish homeless, let's call them camps, let's call them parks, for people that are currently homeless. And what I have learned, at least hearsay, is that city councilors are being pushed really hard by residents in the affluent neighborhoods to do whatever they can not to have those kind of people in their backyards. We don't want that. Do whatever you can not to have that happen. And consequently, we end up with concentrations in of course, the neighborhoods that are already severely impacted with people who are at the margins or even under the margins as far as the economics are concerned. So what can we do as a Sangha? I think that those of us who are in those neighborhoods need to be present, need to be that voice, need to be
to their city council.
Need to be present to voice another more thoughtful, more open way of looking at these problems. That is one way I think that we individually, as opposed to as a Sangha, could affect some of the dialogue that is currently occurring.
Absolutely. You know, having lived for so long in the Bay Area and having so many friends still there who are keeping an eye on these things, I do know that there are other jurisdictions, other municipalities who have really taken a different approach and who have taken on more responsibility for the well-being of the people that don't have any homes that are living in their communities and have taken things a little further insofar as providing encampments that also have access to social services and that have means of governing, monitoring the behavior of the people that live there so they don't have an afflictive effect on the people in the area that, you know, that live around them. But it really does take an affirmative assertion of responsibility for the well-being of others on the part of the jurisdiction in order for that to occur. And that's something that doesn't seem to have occurred here in Denver yet. Like you said, it just seems to be, you know, treating them more or less like refuse, you know, and kind of squeaking them off to the place where the people who have the least power and ability to avoid being afflicted by them wind up with them in their backyard. And it's right. It simply is a manifestation of, again, of the calaces, you know. And I think that it's going to take a lot of, and there are other people in other communities of faith that are been speaking out about this for a while. But it's going to take an ongoing dialogue. I think that there is real resistance to awakening, you know, the power of denial, of not wanting to acknowledge the severity of the problem, the need to do something about it. It's quite strong. So to some extent, I see it as just the need to overcome the powers of delusion or denial in order to clearly see the problem and then to do something about it, whatever that turns out to be. Yeah. Thank you. Appreciate it. Others, anyone, the thought or insight they'd like to share?
Jim wants to share something.
Jim, please.
Hi again. Good to see you, Tara Boyd. You know, I think about mass incarceration, which the system uses that to do for-profit prisons, mass incarceration of migrant peoples, and those internment camps or detention centers are for-profit. GEO is for-profit right across the border in East Denver and Aurora. Then there was something else. Gosh, losing my train of thought. I apologize. So how does, when we look at social issues like that, I remember now, I was raised in the South, and it was clear to me that all police departments that I knew of were racist, and they were founded on racist principles, mm-hmm. especially in the South, but not only in the South, all over the country. They were made to keep certain peoples down. It made to keep certain immigrants groups down during certain immigration cycles. The Irish were brutally treated by police departments on the East Coast, mm-hmm. as were Southern and Eastern Europeans and the Italians, and it's a long road to try to find some way to repair that long history of racist policing in our country. Community policing is a new idea only in the last past mm-hmm. generation. So we got a long way to go. And so I'm wondering, I guess the question I would have, Lloyd, is how do we use Buddhist spiritual practice to try to resolve some of these deep set white supremacist aspects of our culture?
Yeah, I think for me, it's just, and I would invite anyone else who would like to also share a thought about that question, but for me, it comes back to the issue of what it is that they're being asked to do. What is it that we are asking them to do, you know? And basically what they are being asked to do or ordered to do is to simply reinforce and enforce the existing caste system, right? The existing social hierarchy. And so rather than becoming dismayed about the way they're going about doing that, I think we're invited to ask the question whether they should be being commanded to perform that function in the first place, you know, which is to say, are there ways for us to order society that are less coercive, that are less repressive, that are more oriented or geared toward trying to be sort of support to the betterment of everyone who finds themselves in dire straits, rather than putting so much effort into simply keeping them in their place. But that is, that bespeaks a different kind of fundamental motivation insofar as what we ask institutions of government like police departments to do to begin with. And so I think that maybe that's a more fundamental level to go at it from, you know, is this what we want police to be doing, or is there something else that, is there a different way altogether to figure out how to order ourselves as a society? Yeah. Carol? Unmute.
There we go. I wonder, rather than police officers being commanded to do the will of society in terms of keeping people in their place, I wonder if police officers themselves don't participate in the system, and that maybe there is a certain benefit, advantage to them to feel that they are enforcing their own privileged place in society vis-a-vis the people they're supposed to be policing. I mean, I think it's too simple to say that the police officer are just sort of cogs in this machine that's dictated from on high. I think everybody, even the people that are fairly low in the pecking order, are part of that system in which everybody gets something out of it personally.
Yeah.
That there's a sense of I'm part of this hierarchy, but at least I'm not the lowest of the low. At least I'm not the guy that I'm putting in prison. And that
right.
I feel like I have an important place in that system, that hierarchical system, even if I'm not.
Yeah, that I think, it's a really good point. And I think that it goes to the question of why someone might decide they want to be a police officer in the first place. Mm-hmm. Again, with the people that I was working with in class, one of the things that a lot of these people who are, many of whom are already pretty senior in police departments, one of the things they really lamented, interestingly, was the degree to which American culture is saturated in violence, not just in terms of news coverage, but also in terms of the entertainment media. They said, you watch any cops and robbers show on the air, and there's probably going to be somebody get blown away by the police, you know? And so if we're out there doing our work, and at the end of the day, you know, we're able to talk somebody out of a bad situation or resolve a difficult situation instead of having to get in a gunfight, people feel like we haven't done our jobs. You know, it's like there seems to almost be this hunger, I think, that's really fed by the entertainment media for police to be militarized and for police to be violent, that somehow or another that's an indicator that they are, that they're doing, you know, what we want them to be doing. And so, you know, some of the commanders that, you know, that I've, you know, worked with in class over the years said, kind of gives me the creeps when somebody applies to be in the police department because they're really looking forward to carrying a gun and lording it over other people. You know, there's some departments where they don't have a problem with that, but for the most part, for more enlightened police leadership that's trying to get people that aren't so trigger happy, it can be kind of an uphill battle because society as a whole really kind of seems to want something else. And so, it's also, and like you were saying, it's interesting that, you know, we now have a statewide law that's just been passed to try to professionalize standards for monitoring police behavior, for training police and for monitoring their behavior. The police officer who wound up killing in cold blood a kid in, you know, Rocky Ford in southeastern Colorado a few years ago, he'd been fired from three other police departments for beating people he had arrested, right? And he would just go to another department and get hired. And so we're trying to kind of try to put a stop to that, but it goes to this question of what do we want police to do on our behalf? And I think that, and you know, these are policy level questions, you know. If we just want them to enforce the social order and nothing more, then that's what we're gonna get. You know, we have to be, you know, really trying to, I think, ensure that they are motivated differently, that they're coming from a different place. Thank you. Paul, hand up again. Yeah. Muted. Still muted.
All right, we ready? Going back to what you said earlier, while we were talking about Dharma, you reminded us about our past and how we have to be mindful of the tortured states of mind that we might be in our past that led us to these maybe flawed behaviors. And I think that some compassion for police officers and others, including our current government, requires us as Buddhists to be compassionate and to recognize the tortured states of mind that these individuals are existing in. Most specifically, I think of the sociological work that points to something called fundamental attribution error, which is, you know, a pretty wise way to look at how we see ourselves in the world. And how we see ourselves in the world makes us, it's easy for us to attribute moral problems to folks who are outside of who we are, who I am, who I represent. Whereas in the same position, I would attribute it to, well, I just happened to be there. I didn't have any other alternative but to work in that fashion. And so we imply those, or we apply those moral judgments on individuals. And I think we need to be mindful and compassionate enough to understand that we're all flawed and we all behave badly. And it's not a moral issue when it's ours, but it might be a moral issue when it's somebody else's.
Thank you. Thank you, Paul. It's like, remind me of that line, that W.H. Auden quote, you know, love your crooked neighbor with all your crooked heart. This is a wonderful reminder of a piece that I didn't emphasize a little bit earlier, that when you are able to look at past behaviors, speech or action that you might regret that may have caused suffering for yourself or others, the remorse that naturally arises is part of it. But the other really crucial aspect of it is compassion, is self-compassion. Oh, look who I was at the time that I did that. Look at the state of mind that I was in that resulted in my doing what I did. And that also holds true for things that were harmful or painful things that were done to us by others. You know, whether or not forgiveness happens to be possible in the moment, at least there's that insight. Oh, you know, how tortured their mind must have been in order for them to have behaved in the way that they did. And sometimes when, you know, there's a certain amount of equanimity and open-heartedness, I find that I can also bring that to bear on the actions of political leaders the actions of whom I continue to feel are abhorrent. And yet there's something in me that can say, what must be the tortured state of mind that would allow somebody or encourage somebody to do what they did? You know, it's obvious that it's coming from a place of horrible dukkha. You know, they must be inhabiting a hellish realm in order for that kind of behavior to ensue. And so that can be helpful insofar as not to ameliorating the other rising, you know, to say, oh my goodness, you know, there is so much dukkha that needs to be recognized and reconciled. And may that person come to a place of peace so they no longer need to behave in that way. Thank you, Paul. That was a really nice way to wrap up our time together this evening. If we can take just a moment to get back into our sitting postures and allow the eyes to gently close and the attention to come to rest on our breathing. As we go forth this evening and into the world and into daily life, may we live with ease and know ease of well-being. May we be safe from all inner and outer harm. May we know the depth of our own and others' suffering. May we meet that suffering with compassion for ourselves and for others. May we be at peace with things as they are. May we be happy. May we be peaceful. May we be free. May our friends, families, loved ones, all those whom we hold dear, be happy and peaceful and free. May all beings be happy. May all beings be peaceful. May all beings be liberated. Thanks for coming around this evening, everybody. Have a good week. Stay safe and be well.
Thanks, Lloyd.
Yeah. See ya.
Thank you. Good night.
Thank you.